Those of you joining us, I'm still Mark Larson from San Diego Radio and Television, Reagan Ranch Board of Governors member. That's especially for those of you watching on YAF.org. Let's give a round of applause to the countless numbers across America, around the world, watching us on YAF.org. You should visit often, yes. And because you weren't here earlier, you missed me slightly mangling the name of one of our participants, and it's Ilinka, who I called Ilinka. I think I referred to you both Ilinka and Ilinka. And I know that. I know a little Romanian. I do. Te iubesc. Huh? I'm still working on English phonetically, but that's a separate thing. Great day today. We're going to have a great time here hearing from our keynote speaker, and you get the tag team. You get both the senator and his wife today, and again, the books are going to be available to you as well. So thank you again for joining us here at the Reagan Ranch Center in the Roundtable Series. And again, go to ReaganRanch.org, go to YAF.org. People always ask, how can I get more involved? You can start by talking to our staff here. You can also go online anytime. That's a great way to just send things out to your friends, especially friends who are on the opposite side of the issues. Just say, hey, here's a little something, and here, take a look at the Reagan Ranch. And here's, and then link them up to YAF.org. Great resources, and does a lot of the work for you in terms of making sure we get people thinking properly here. To set us off and to introduce our guest today, it's Carolee Geis, who's serving as the Capitol Hill Outreach Director for Young America's Foundation. She first became familiar with YAF during her summer in the Young Leaders Program of the Heritage Foundation, and was inspired to start a Young Americans for Freedom chapter on the campus at Samford University. That effort received national attention after some members of the faculty senate deemed the group offensive to communists. That's right up there with years ago in the UC system. Angela Davis was on the Board of Regents. She went, oh, well, at least it's truth in advertising. All right. Prior to joining YAF's team, she served on the staff for Congressman Bruce Westerman in his Capitol Hill office. Carolee is enthusiastic about encouraging students who intern on Capitol Hill and in Washington, D.C. to further their involvement with YAF and inspire their peers with conservative ideas. Please please welcome Carolee Geis to introduce our guests.
All right. Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. And thank you all for joining us not only here but also online. There's thousands of people around the world participating in this event through YAF's virtual pass. If you're watching on YouTube or Facebook but not participating through the virtual pass, head to yaf.org/virtualpass to submit questions for the senator and his wife to answer live after the lecture. Without further ado, it is an honor to introduce one of the nation's leading advocates for liberty, Senator Rand Paul. Elected to the United States Senate in 2010, Dr. Paul has proven to be an outspoken champion for constitutional liberties and fiscal responsibility. As a fierce advocate against government overreach, Dr. Paul has fought tirelessly to return government to its limited and constitutional scope. As a hardworking and dedicated physician, not a career politician, Dr. Paul came to Washington to shake things up and make a difference. Dr. Paul's a devoted husband and father of three that is currently living with his family in Bowling Green, Kentucky. There, Dr. Paul owned his own ophthalmology practice where he performed eye surgery for 18 years. Dr. Paul has been married to his wife, Kelly Ashby Paul of Russellville, Kentucky for 25 years. So also joining is Kelly Paul. She previously authored her own book, True and Constant Friends. She's on the board of Helping a Hero, which works with wounded veterans. She's an outspoken advocate for criminal justice reform, and worked with the White House to pass the First Step Act. One interesting fact about Kelly, she's actually a bird watcher, and right in her backyard has a pair of bald eagles that nest there every year. Pretty American family, if we can agree there. So during his free time, Dr. Paul performs pro bono eye surgeries for patients across the state of Kentucky. Additionally, he provides free eye surgery for children around the world. Recently, he traveled to Guatemala and Haiti on a medical mission trip. And during his time there, over 300 patients, many blind with cataracts, had their vision restored. As As a constitutional conservative in the United States Senate, Senator Paul has introduced legislation to defund Planned Parenthood, balance the budget by cutting a penny out of every dollar spent, and fully funding the southern border wall by cutting foreign aid to countries that burn the American flag, such as Pakistan and the Palestinian territories. So Senator Paul wrote his latest book with his wife, Kelly Paul. The Case Against Socialism is a timely book which focuses on the dangers and perils of socialism, which has become increasingly accepted in today's society. Senator Paul makes a compelling case that Bernie Sanders' vision is not only misguided, but actually dangerous. And perhaps eating your dog might not be the best future for America. Dr. Paul's entrance into politics is indicative of his life's work as a surgeon, a desire to diagnose problems and provide practical solutions. So please help me welcome two friends and supporters of Young America's Foundation, Senator Rand Paul and Mrs. Kelly Paul.
So you may think, there's no way. Parabald Eagles, Carol Lee Miss, who's made that up? That's absolutely true, and they've been coming for about 5 years now. And they had a pair of hatchlings that grew, and one thing you can know about bald eagles is the hatchlings don't have the white head for 2 or 3 years. Now, we haven't seen them since. They're like all teenagers. They're gone. They've flown the nest. When I come back to YAF, I was here a couple years ago. I see friendly faces. I see people who've been part of the movement. Let's see, a few of you for more than a year or two. Kind of like me, we've been around, we've seen Ronald Reagan as president, but some of us may even remember Ronald Reagan from the 1950s. Okay, most of us remember just by watching the video, but it was pretty incredible when you watch him. He worked for GE traveling the country, and that's what I think about a little bit when I think about this book, is that, he was making the case for capitalism, the case for free markets, free enterprise, and you think, well, that was in the 1950s, I guess it's been made, we should be fine, right? Everybody should know that, capitalism is the system. Capitalism is what gave America its great wealth. But it's dangerous. There's a whole new generation that doesn't really know that or remember that. We have polling now, and this is one of the reasons Kelly and I got together on this book. We have polling that says that over half of young people actually think that they have a favorable perception of socialism. And you're like, really? And you're like, what are they doing in our government schools? What are they teaching these kids? Now, the only good news is that the polling shows that over successive decades, people get a little bit more knowledgeable about socialism and less favorable to it over time. It's kind of similar to the comment, if you're not a liberal before 30, you don't have a heart, but if you're not conservative after 30, you don't have a brain. I think it has something to do with also paying your own bills. When you're living in your parents' basement, it's a little like communism or socialism, but when you get out and you're making your own money and you're seeing, what's that FICA? What's that income tax? Once you start seeing that, you start maybe believing that you want less government, not more. But we are alarmed about this, and we do think that every generation has to sort of redo its fight and renew its zeal for liberty. As we began looking at this, I was teaching a course at George Washington, and it was on the dystopian novel. And most people have read 1984, but a lot of people don't remember that preceding 1984 was Brave New World, about a decade before. Also, Ayn Rand's Anthem preceded 1984. But there's even a lesser-known novel called We by Zamyatin, another Russian novelist, who actually really, they say, is maybe the grandfather of the dystopian novel. But you go back even one step further to the 19th century, and you get to one of my favorite authors, Dostoevsky. And Dostoevsky wrote something called Notes from Underground. And in it, he talks about this guy. When you first read it, if you don't know what's going on or you haven't read of socialism, what they called it back in those days, nihilism, you really may not know what he's doing. It's just, who is this crazy guy, that wants to stick his tongue out at the Crystal Palace? But his point was basically this. Wasn't that socialism doesn't work, or that constructing and telling man what to do, man or woman, telling us what to do, basically, that even if it worked, we might not want it. That basically it goes against our very nature, the idea that a structured society where the ends are all known, the ends are purposeful and rational. But even if it worked, in the apotheosis of this is this Crystal Palace that was built in the 1850s in England. It was sort of the height of man's perfection. and man's perfectibility of things. And Dostoevsky made it this symbol. But he said, you know, maybe you just might want to stick your tongue out of it just because you want to prove that you're alive, kind of thing. The other thing he talked about was that living is about attaining, not always achieving. And think about it in your own life. We have achievements, but really wasn't the fine part of your life trying to get to the achievement. It's the act of attaining that is our life, but it's also the act of you choosing the attaining. If I tell you the ends and government tells you what are going to be the ends, it's like, well, then why bother, you know, if we don't have our free will? But this is a point when you look at utopias and when you look at dystopias that they sort of defy man's nature. Plato and others said we were going to have disinterested philosopher kings, and they would act just in the best interest of mankind. But even the Soviets and Marx began to think, you know what, that isn't man's nature. Man's nature is to be self-interested, and how are we going to do that? So the Soviets said, well, we need to have a new Soviet man. We're going to create men. And this is what an author by the name of Chernyshevsky did back in the 19th century, and the response to Chernyshevsky was, even if it works, this is Dostoevsky's response, even if it were to work, what about our free will? What about our freedom? Wouldn't it be something that we aren't willing to give up even if it actually did work? So that's sort of the philosophical underpinnings of the idea that our individual liberty and our rights and our free will should not be secondary or subjected to the desires of the collective. That's it in a broad nutshell. But then the question is, if we don't want to give up our freedom, we don't want to give up our free will, what about the practicalities of it? The other side says it works. Well, they haven't read any history if they believe it works, because time and time again, for the last 100 years, every time that socialism has been tried, it's been a failure. Not only a failure, really it's invariably associated with genocide and with famine. I think most of the young people have no idea even who Mao is. You know, the Little Red Book sold billions of copies, and I remember even when I was in college, oh, it's neat to have the Little Red Book of Mao, and it's like, really? 50 million people died from famine in China in the late 1950s. There's a story we include in the book where there's a report from one of the provinces, and it's sent back to headquarters in Beijing, and they said, well, the people are dying everywhere. They're laying in the street, and the dogs are eating the dead. And so being a very efficient bureaucrat, he went out there, and he studied it, and he wrote his report, and he came back, and he says, it's absolutely not true. The dogs are not eating the dead because the dogs were eaten long ago. Pretty chilling. And you think, well, that's just one off. And people say, we don't want Mao socialism. Bernie says, oh, no, that's not what we're talking about. That's not the kind of socialism. But this happens time and again. When Stalin's socialism was going on in the Soviet Union, Walter Duranty, what was that paper? Oh, yeah, the fake New York Times. He was with the fake New York Times. He won a Pulitzer for his reporting on the Soviet Union. He went over and said how great Stalin was and how the economy was great and booming, and we had American intellectuals going over there and sucking up to the Soviets and saying how great it was. And people kept apologizing for the Soviet socialism until you finally get to Khrushchev, and even Khrushchev finally admits that millions of people were being killed. But the new socialists, they say, oh, that's not what we want. That's not what we want at all. We want a kinder, gentler kind of socialism. But the question, as I was teaching my course on the dystopian novel, that the students kept asking me, is violence invariably, is violence inevitable with socialism? Is there a link? So I was on this crazy program. I don't suggest anybody ever go on at The View. So we're on this program, and I'm saying Chavez in Venezuela, Maduro, they're socialists. And then Ana Navarro starts yelling at me, he's just a murderer and a thug. And I'm like, yes, he's a murderer, a thug, and a socialist. And that's sort of one of the things the book's about. Is there a relationship between socialism and authoritarianism? Hayek and others wrote about this, and they said that really it's not an accident that we get dictators. It's not an accident that they're ruthless. If you want to take the property from people, which is the definition of socialism, if the government's going to own the means of production, someone already owns them. So you've got to take them. Now, you can go halfway. You could say, let's say, like the Republic of California, you can have like 50, 60% taxes, and maybe you won't resist, although some of the people have been moving. We see them in other parts of the country. But the thing is you might not resist, but my guess is there's a point in time when they take your property that you resist. And the only way you can have a dictator that can efficiently give you complete socialism is he's got to be, or she, has to be ruthless. They've got to have the spine to go in and take your property and have the spine to put you in jail. They have to have clubs, they have to have fairness police, and they have to have equality police. The one thing I think the left misses on this is both left and right, and I think all of us now, believe that the law should have equal protection. If I tell you that, you say absolutely. No matter what color your skin is, male, female, no matter what about your lifestyle, we should all be treated equally. And I think everybody believes that. The law should be the same for everyone. But here's one of the things about socialism. If we're going to have equality of outcome, if we're all going to be equal when you walk out the door, if I give you all $1,000 and a week later we want to all be equal, I'm going to have to do something because you're not all equal. Someone's going to be a harder worker. Someone's going to have an idea. Someone's going to make something. And the distribution of what you once had will change. So if I want to make you equal in outcome, interestingly, I have to treat you in an unequal way before the law. And this is the thing we need to get the kids to understand because they're for fairness. And some fairness is good. Equal protection of the law is good. You should all be treated the same. But realize if you want equal outcome, because we're not equal, the law has to treat you in an unequal way. But what they keep saying is oh, what we want is a kinder, gentler socialism. What we want is what they've got in Scandinavia.
And that's the those are the chapters that I worked on. We decided, since Denmark and Sweden come up so often in the speeches of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, we thought, all right, well, let's really take a look at what they actually do in those countries. And through our research, what we found out is they don't actually do any of the things that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren are proposing. For example, they don't have wealth taxes. They had low corporate taxes until the Trump tax cuts of last year. Their corporate taxes were significantly less than ours. They also reject the term or the label socialist. The president of Denmark actually called out Bernie about a year or so ago saying, please stop referring to our country as socialist. We are a capitalist. We have a stock market. We are open for business. And so they reject that. I think a lot of the reason that people associate those countries with socialism is, A, they did flirt pretty heavily with socialism back in the 70s and 80s. And at that point, they were very wealthy countries. I think Sweden was number fourth in the world in terms of wealth. But all of their industry and all of their major companies were formed before the 1970s, or most of the largest ones were. And then they did. They had extremely high wealth taxes during that time, a lot of punitive, very punitive taxes on the wealthy. And guess what happened? The wealthy left. The founder of IKEA left Sweden, Bjorn Borg. I mean, then they saw their capital leaving and they were plunged into a really, really steep decline and a tough recession in the 90s. And they've been actually electing center-right governments really since the 1990s and rolling back a lot of this stuff. So they are capitalist countries, but they do have they have retained a lot of their welfare state items, like the national healthcare system that you hear a lot about and the free education. But the interesting thing that Bernie and Elizabeth aren't going to tell you about how they actually pay for all of that is that it's incredibly regressively taxed there. The U.S. is a much more progressively taxed country than those countries. So, for example, when the wealthy fled and they were trying to lure them back in the early 2000s, they dropped all of the punitive wealth taxes. So they don't have wealth taxes. They don't have minimum wage. In 2007, I think, is when they lowered their corporate tax to be very low. And consequently, you know, their economies have gone through the roof. They did retain their national health system. But what they do differently there is that for them, the 60% tax rate starts at around $60,000. And that's not something that they're going to admit to you. It's just a mathematics problem. There aren't enough people to tax that heavily, the very rich. So they have pretty much a 60% tax rate starting at that level, and then that's about where it stays. I think from 60,000 to like 500,000, it's at 60%. The other thing that they do in all those countries, and I don't know if anybody here has traveled to Scandinavia recently, but it's incredibly, incredibly expensive. And one of the reasons is every single thing that they buy has a 25% sales tax or value-added tax, they call it, on everything, including food, a dozen eggs, a can of beans, a pair of jeans, everything is taxed, has a 25%, and that is all along the chain of production that 25% VAT hits. So it's very expensive. Now, obviously, the poorer you are and the lower your income, your consumption is a much higher percentage of what you're spending on. So that really relates to the poor paying an effective higher tax rate than the rich do in those countries. So they have the VAT, they have the high middle class taxes. And you know, the other thing that they have that I think a lot of people in the United States would kind of be horrified by is very, very high automobile taxes. I always say, you know, when people like to talk about Denmark and they, you know, we see these articles like in the New York Times or whatever, and they say the Danes are the happiest people in the world. And they're healthier than we are, they're taller, they're thinner, they're fitter, they're just happier, and it must be that socialized medicine, right? And what do they always show? They show a picture of a healthy, fit, thin Dane on a bike. Well, guess what? Their car taxes are 200% on a car. So I don't know if too many Americans would really want to be going to bike transportation in a frigid climate like Denmark. Actually, last year, I have a good friend who's a Danish journalist, and I got a lot of my information from her. I quote her a lot in the book. And she said that they did actually have a libertarian movement about a year ago and had elected quite a few libertarians, and they lowered their car tax finally to 100%. So, you know, they're moving in the direction of Reagan, I guess. I don't know. So
when you think about it, let's see, everything Bernie says about Scandinavia is untrue. So Bernie says that they're socialists. They're not. They have a big welfare state. But Bernie also says he's going to offer you all of the so-called free stuff that they have in Scandinavia, and only the rich are going to have to pay for it. AOC has a special wealth tax. They want to tax people making more than $10 million a year. Every one of their schemes to tax the wealthy bring in not nearly enough, exponentially less than what they want to spend. So the tax on people making $10 million, I think, was going to bring in $50 billion. Medicare for all is somewhere, they say $30 trillion. Our side says $60 trillion. Give or take a few trillion, you know, $30, $60 trillion. It's going to be extraordinarily expensive. So they're not socialists in Scandinavia. They do have a welfare state, but it's paid for by the working class and the middle class. So those lies enough should be enough to destroy any of the allure of socialism. But there's one final lie that I'd like to point out, and this is the lie that if you get rich, I must get poor. It's absolutely false. There is no statistical evidence, no historical evidence that it's true. And in fact, everything about our country, everything about the greatness of America, you know, they say, who's that guy that says, make America great again, yeah. But I always say we got to know what made America great. And what made America great was basically being largely left alone, protecting our God-given liberties, and basically, if you have something to sell, letting you sell it, as long as you do it fair, you know, through your contract and you don't try to cheat anyone. But if you look at the statistics, it's amazing. Our economy has doubled 8 times since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. At the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, everybody lived in poverty. And see, this had been going on for thousands of years. Since sort of man sort of came out of caves and started agriculture and started invented the wheel, they were along the x-axis. I mean, just everybody was poor. 90% of people in 1820 were living in extreme poverty. This is less than $2 a day. Fast forward to when I was born in the 1960s, and it went from 90% extreme poverty to a third. And a lot of this is what Adam Smith talked about, the invisible hand, the division of labor, not only among people, but the division of labor among countries and free trade that allowed this to happen. So we go from 90% extreme poverty to a third. This isn't being reported. From the time I was born to today, less than 10% of the world lives in extreme poverty. It is a miracle of economic growth that has never, ever been witnessed in the history of time. And I was on with Jake Tapper the other day, and I was kind of excited. And I said, this is the best time ever, 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 ever to be alive. And it really is. It's all good news. You wouldn't think so by watching TV and everybody yelling at each other. But the economy is growing by leaps and bounds. Poverty is being wiped out. The economic pie is growing. It isn't, if you get rich, I must get poor. Everybody's getting richer. The rich are getting richer. The poor are getting richer. The middle class are getting richer. Bernie says the middle class is being decimated. Well, yeah, because they're moving into the upper class.
We do. We take them to task because you find that because they can't really argue on the actual numbers right now because the economy is doing so well. We have 7 million jobs unfilled. Unemployment is so low. The median income is now grown by like $3,000 since Trump was elected to be $65,000. So again, because they can't really complain about that, they say, well, it's inequality. We're worried because, you know, there's such unequal incomes. But what we found looking at some economists who look at the poorest quintiles in our country versus the richest is, yes, while there is significant income inequality in terms of money income, the inequality in terms of consumption, what you can buy with your money and your lifestyle, is actually shrinking considerably because of cheap goods and trade and the trade agreements. The World Bank statistics show that the poorest 20% of American citizens, the poorest, consume more goods and services than the median income of people in wealthy countries in Europe and Scandinavia.
So Thomas Piketty wrote this book a few years ago. He's a socialist from France, and the left just loved this book about income inequality, and he argued you can't have economic growth if you get too much income inequality. Well, it turns out if you look at developed nations, income inequality, as it widens, is actually proportional to economic growth. Now, if you look at developing countries, there are some different data on it, but if you look at countries like ours, as our income inequality has gotten worse over the last 40 years, we've had more economic growth. And if you look at the way it's divided up, you could say, well, what is it you really want? I mean, Pakistan and Ethiopia have less income inequality than us. Raise your hand if you're wanting to move to Pakistan or Ethiopia. So it really isn't the whole thing. Steven Pinker wrote a book, Enlightenment Now, and in it he pointed out, you know, Piketty and Bernie Sanders will say, well, the poor only have 5% of the wealth, and that's all they had 100 years ago, and they're just, it's just terrible. Well, 5% of a pie that was this big is a lot smaller than 5% of the pie we have today. It's just amazing what's going on. There's a group called humanprogress.org, and it's worth looking at it. The statistics are astounding, what you can buy. In 1919, you could buy one basket of goods, of food, for a certain amount of average worker hours. The same amount of average worker hours 100 years later buys seven times as much food. It used to be that a third of our income was food, and now it's like 12% of our income is food. Things are just getting better by leaps and bounds. And then when I said this to Trevor Noah on the Comedy Central show, didn't get any laughs, but he said, well, yeah, food's going down, clothing's going down, but healthcare and education are going up. And my response to him was, what's common between healthcare and education? The government. The government's so heavily involved that they're subsidizing demand. This is what I keep telling them. Nobody gets it in Washington. Drug prices are doing this, and so are insurance premiums for the individual market. I said, well, if you just give people money to pay for stuff that is very expensive and getting more expensive, what do you think happens? It gets more expensive. So what we've done through Obamacare is, sure, we helped out some people who had expensive insurance. All that money went from those people to the insurance companies, and the rates for our insurance just kept going up. What we need is the opposite, and there are a couple simple things.
And the insurance company profits doubled under Obamacare.
Yeah.
They were bought off.
And there are some things we could do that would...
That's crony capitalism. That's not capitalism, that's crony.
But when we look at this, I think it's important, because most of us here do believe there is an American greatness. It's important for us to know what it came from. And so we can just be sort of nationalist and say America's great. Or we can say America's great and this is the reason why. And I think Reagan was really good at that, particularly back in the 50s when he started out explaining what capitalism was and what free markets were and what free enterprise was. We need that. Every generation's got to have that. Jefferson said every new generation has to water the tree of liberty. It absolutely is that. Our hope is that the case against socialism will be a part of that for not only people on our side, but for our young people then to turn to the young people on campus and say, the Scandinavians aren't socialist. The taxes are massive on the poor and the working class. If we can have that success and others will join us, I think that we can continue to preserve the great country that we have. Thank you much for having us. And I think we have time for a few questions. If they're hard, Kelly has to answer them. If they're easy, I'll take the easy ones.
We will have, if any supporters in the room would like to raise a question, if you or ask a question, if you raise your hand, I'll bring you the mic. Madison will start us off with a virtual pass question, and then we'll switch off.
Our first question is from Jackson from Galveston, Texas. He says, thank you for giving those of us participating in this event online the opportunity to ask you a question. How would you define success with regards to Syria, and what are the immediate steps the U.S. should take?
I thought I said only easy questions. Yeah. Now, I would say it's very messy, and I think we should all acknowledge that from the beginning. Our founding fathers had a couple of principles that they put in the Constitution. They did not want presidents to go to war on their own decision. They really wanted it to be a legislative function. Madison said that the executive branch is most prone to war, therefore, with studied care, we vested that power in the legislature. Now, we haven't always obeyed that in recent times. Bush did come to Congress with the Iraq War and also with the 2001 resolution. The problem has been is that nobody out there now that we're addressing has anything to do with either one of those resolutions. So to say that we're going to go after the people who attacked us on 9/11 or aided or harbored them really has nothing to do with Syria. So if we want to be at war in Syria, what I've said to Lindsey Graham and a few others is that you got to come to Congress. You got to ask permission. And the reason they don't want to do that is it's so messy. Who would we declare war on? Are we going to declare war? Turkey's not behaving well, but are we going to declare war on them? We had 50 soldiers. I think the president made the wise decision. You do not go to war with 50 soldiers. I'm of the belief, and we used to believe that as Republicans, some of us who say you got to go to war, you got to go where you go big or you go home. You know, when we've gone to war and we send, you know, huge amounts of troops, we bomb all the air defenses, we completely control the skies, we don't go and leave 50 people in the middle of something. And when Reagan had that happen to him in Beirut, he made the decision it wasn't an advisable thing to do. 50 troops are a trigger to a calamity. And people say, oh, I don't care, it's symbolic, and we have to help the Kurds. You tell that to the parents of those 50 kids. But I would say this. The Kurds have been our allies, and we should try to do something. There has to be a resolution, but the war's gone on 8 years. I think there actually is a possibility that their alliance with Assad is going to be a good thing. We have prevented the alliance with Assad. We have said we want Assad gone. This is sort of Lindsey Graham versus the other wing of the Republican Party. And I think the president, frankly, is in my side on this, is that regime change doesn't always make it better. When we got rid of Gaddafi, we didn't elect Thomas Jefferson in Libya. I don't think the same will happen in Syria. Assad is a despot, but frankly, Erdogan's a despot as well. So do you want to send your kids to fight for either one of them? You say, well, I'm going to fight for the Kurds. Well, many of the Kurds actually are socialists as well, so it is more confusing than we actually think. But here's my point. We were never staying. The president said we're going to wipe out ISIS and we're coming home, and that's what we're doing. If they want a homeland, they need a protector. It's not going to be us. The president says it's not going to. Now, every Democrat up there wants to be the Kurds' protector. You would have to send tens of thousands of troops in there. 50 are not a deterrent. And so if you want to be the Kurds' protector and give them the Kurds' homeland, I think they need a friend. They need an ally. And so as imperfect as Assad is, the war's largely over and he's staying. Short of an assassination by his own people, the war part of it's largely over. If he were to protect them and they make a deal, the Kurds are pretty fierce fighters. They've been the best fighters over there if you give them equipment, and we have. And really, they shouldn't go running around saying bad things about America. People say, oh, they fought our war for us. No, they didn't. They fought their war. We helped them fight their war. They lived there. And ISIS were terrible people chopping the heads off of people in their villages. We helped them with their war. They should be eternally thankful to us. But the thing is they need a protector and an ally. The natural ally, the only one that is going to be protecting them in Syria would be Assad. It means the Russians, too, but it also means the Iranians. It's very, very messy. But here's the thing. Turkey needs to be reassured that the Kurds are not going to make incursions into Turkey. They weren't accepting the Kurds' word for it, and they probably weren't going to. Is there a possibility that Erdogan and Assad could come to an agreement? Well, I think the president and Pompeo and the vice president deserve a lot of credit for being on the spot very quickly in Turkey. And they've had this discussion, and I predicted this before I even knew this was happening. There's a possibility Turkey will pull back within days to weeks and pull back inside of Turkey if Syria will agree to patrol that. And then is there a possibility? I can't predict the future. I mean, it's a messy war, so if I do predict the future, it may be an accident. But I will say that there's a chance that there could be a Kurdish semi-autonomous region in Syria. That's what happened in Iraq. It was very messy. There was fighting back and forth. At one time, the Iraq government that we supported went into the Kurdish area, and it was messy. But right now, there's actually a pretty good semi-autonomous area that the Kurds run in Iraq. That's what I would like to see in Syria. But we were never protecting it, and we'd have to vote on it. We'd just have to vote on it. You have to agree to send your kids and your grandkids to this war, which I'm not sure exactly I want to fight for Assad. I'm not so sure I want to fight for Erdogan. And so I think the president did the wise thing.
Senator, thank you very much for coming back to Santa Barbara. I was with my daughters last time you were here, and they think you're the coolest senator. It's true. I'm with a group called Fair Education Santa Barbara, and we're wrestling with this issues, the issues you're bringing up, because it's being taught in our government schools. And this issue we have is of educational proficiency. Within the district here, only 54% of students are not proficient at California state standards. And we're kind of new to this. We're thinking that maybe this issue is the issue of real equity, that if you're not teaching kids to reach proficiency, that's the issue where we're taking away the opportunity. So I'd like your comment on that, and also from a federal vantage point, what can be done here? We're fighting the battle in state court, but what can we do from a federal level? Thank you.
You know, I'm thinking I might vote for secession. I mean, if y'all want to take your debt, take your high taxes, and be your own country. No, on education, I would say that particularly when you're talking about what happens to certain poorer ethnic groups in our country, many people have said, you know, that education and choice in education is the civil rights of our era. I truly believe that. And if we want to have some equality of chance in life and opportunity, it is through education. It doesn't guarantee your outcome, but it certainly gives you a chance. And we're giving a rotten, horrible education to a lot of kids. I will say that when you teach your kids that the world is ending in 12 years, why learn history? You know? I mean, if global warming is going to destroy the world in 12 years, which AOC has said, then why? Why even bother? But I do think that we've done a lot of things. And John Allison was a longtime president of BB&T, and he gives a great speech about self-esteem. And other people have said this, but he said basically that nobody can give you self-esteem. And now our schools are these big factories handing out self-esteem and trophies. We're sorry Johnny can't spell, but he did get a trophy for trying, and that's a problem. And so we've ignored, but part of the answer is this. I'm not an educator and shouldn't tell you how to educate your kids. Shouldn't be done in Washington. You should decide it locally. So really, we should have almost no national control, and I'm still with Ronald Reagan. Let's get rid of the Department of Education. Okay. We have time for one more.
This will be our final question from Virtual Pass. We have Beverly from Fort Pierce, Florida. She asks, what time frame would be reasonable and feasible for paying off our national debts and operating within a balanced budget? What steps would be required?
You gotta love youth. That they're going right past the balanced budget for a year. They want to know how we're going to pay off the debt. And it's a harder question. So I would say start with the easier question is let's try to figure out how to balance our books in 1 year. We currently bring in about $3 trillion in taxes and we spend $4 trillion. That's a big imbalance. It's about $1 trillion imbalance every year. We complained to high heaven. How many people complained about President Obama and the Democrats? We all did. But you elected, most of you I think, three branches of government, House, Senate, and Republican president. And what happened to the debt? We ballooned it back up. And it's mainly because both sides are big spenders. And in the Senate, whenever I put a vote forward to try to balance the budget over 5 years, I'll get about 15 to 20 Republicans, no Democrats, but I'll also lose about 30 Republicans. I call them the big government Republicans. They still are the majority in the U.S. Senate. Most of them been there too long. They are not fiscally conservative, and all they want is money for what they want their money for and the power that goes along with dispersing that money. We have to do a better job. But here's what I tell, and I tell liberal groups that come in and see me. I call the people that come in looking for money, I call them the beseechers. So they come in with their hands outspread, and they say, but it's a really good cause. And a lot of times it is. I mean, it's Alzheimer's disease or hemophilia or diabetes or some terrible tragedy. Like, we're a rich country. Couldn't we help? And I'm not saying we can't, actually. But what I am saying is to everybody that comes asking for money, if you got $100 million last year for your group, could you deal with $99 million next year? That's what the penny plan is. And I've yet to meet somebody, even the very emotional thing like Alzheimer's, my mom and my dad or grandfather have Alzheimer's, and I'm really committed to this, and I want the federal government involved in the research. And I say, well, what if everybody got 1% less? The amazing thing is 1% less over a five-year period balances the budget. And you say, well, how could that possibly work? The reason it works is spending's going up at about 6% a year. So a 1% cut from zero is a 1% cut. But in Washington, this is where we get beaten up. The media will say, oh, he's going to cut $10 trillion over 10 years. No, not. I'm cutting 1%. It's $32 billion, $35 billion a year, each year, over 5 years. But they don't accept that because they accept that the baseline's going up. So they would even say a freeze over 10 years is a $10 trillion cut. Because we're going up at 6% a year, so we're going to spend $10 trillion more than we're spending now. So all of this, they say if you froze spending, I've cut $10 trillion, and I don't care about whether people eat or have a house and all this. And it's like, no, I'm talking about spending 99% of what you spent last year. So that's the first answer. If we did that, there'd be such confidence and exuberance that was spread to Wall Street. We'd do even better than we're doing now. I think there'd be great growth in our country just by showing people that we can balance our budget on an annual basis. And what you do with the rest is you would pay it down gradually over time. And also, as your economy grows, if you're not adding to it, your debt will shrink as a percentage of your economy. And I think we should get rid of a lot of the debt. But the main thing we should do to begin with is let's just quit adding to it. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much. The question didn't deal with it. That was one of the most cogent discussions on socialism in our economy.
Thank you.
And other
how about that? That's better than any Regis and Kelly show.
Continuing to bring attention to how and who and when.
A couple of quick notes. We have the book signing with Senator Paul upstairs. He and Kelly will be upstairs. And you want to make your way up there fairly quickly. Next Reagan Ranch Roundtable is going to be December 6th.
Thank you.
6th of December. Put it on your calendar. More info to follow. Thank you. God bless you. God bless America.